is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington. Joshua Johnson is on assignment. In the Senate chamber on Capitol Hill here in Washington, in the gallery overlooking the Senate floor, there's a place just for journalists who report on the Senate every day. It's where they go to watch the big history-making moments, the votes that send us to war or enact a healthcare law. On a desk above where the senators stand, there's a book that sits like a fixture. It's a permanent reference for understanding what's really going on below. It's a biography. It's the story of Lyndon Johnson and how he used power to bend the Senate to his will and become the greatest majority leader in history. Master of the Senate won a Pulitzer Prize in 2003 for its author, Robert Caro. In 1,100 pages, Caro uses President Johnson to explore how power accretes, how it's used, and the impact of that power on the everyday lives of Americans. It's one installment in the series, The Years of Lyndon Johnson. Now, Caro was already a Pulitzer Prize winner for his 1,300-page 1974 biography about New York infrastructure mogul Robert Moses. It's called The Power Broker. Caro's fans now eagerly await the last installment of the Johnson books, all about the presidential years, the 60s, civil rights, and Vietnam. In the meantime, Robert Caro is out with a new, much shorter book. It's called Working, and it's all about the interviews, the discipline, and the method that have helped Robert Caro enthrall his fans for decades. Robert Caro joins me now from NPR in New York. Mr. Caro, welcome to 1A.
Nice to be here.
Very nice to have you, sir. I know that people constantly ask you when the final LBJ book is going to be finished, and I promise you're going to be spared that here. I'm not going to ask you that. Give you a break from that perennial question, even though you never give your sources a break from your perennial questions. That's okay. The years of Lyndon Johnson have been a 40-year-plus project for you, and Robert Moses, many years before that, when you were a young reporter, there are lots of people with real power in this society. What drew you to these two powerful men?
Well, I was a young journalist. I was a political reporter. And I got interested in Robert Moses. I started to realize we live in a democracy, so we think that power comes from being elected, from our votes at the ballot box. But here was a guy, Robert Moses, who had never been elected to anything. And he had more power than anyone who was elected, more power than any mayor, more than any governor, more than any mayor and governor put together. And he had held this power for 44 years. And with it, he shaped New York, all the highways, the modern bridges, the parks. And I said, I don't understand. I'm supposed to be writing about political power, but I have no idea where he got this power. And I realized, neither did anybody else. And I realized I'd have to write a book to try to find out what it was, because I didn't understand what it was, and to explain it.
A similar impulse for Lyndon Johnson?
In a way, similar. So The Power Broker, you could say, is about urban power, power in cities. Then I wanted to do national power. And I had learned, I hoped, with The Power Broker, that if you pick the right man, you could show a lot about political power through his life. And I knew I wanted to do national power next, and I knew I wanted to do it through Lyndon Johnson, because I felt his life, he understood national power. And I felt I could do a lot through his life.
You mentioned those early days as a young reporter, a young political reporter, when you looked up from your daily deadlines and your daily stories and realized, wait, power is important, and why does this unelected man have so much of it? You got your start as a beat reporter at Newsday on Long Island. Take me back, if you can. How do you remember those days and the clattering teletypes and the grumpy editors in the newsroom?
You know, I loved being a reporter then. As you say, the newsroom was full of, you know, shouting back and forth. I worked nights for a while. I think my hours were 7:30 at night till 3:30 in the morning. And if you looked around the room about 3 o'clock, you saw everybody with their headsets on, and you knew they were making dates for when they got off at 3:30. You could tell who was dating who by who was talking on a headset and who was listening. But I had an editor who was like an old guy out of the front page days in Chicago, a tough old guy named Alan Hathaway. I had never done any kind of investigative work, and through a real accident, meaning everyone else was on the Newsday picnic on Fire Island, no one could get them on the telephone because this was, I guess, about 1966 or 67. No one had cell phones. And a tip came in on a very important story we were working on. They couldn't get any of the regular investigative reporters, so finally the editor said to me, you'll have to go down and do it. It was looking through files, secret files, that were suddenly being made available to us at the Federal Aviation Agency at Idlewild Airport, later Kennedy Airport. And I went down, I just loved it, but I didn't know that I knew what I was doing. I wrote a long memo so that the real reporters who came in later could write the story. And the next day, this old guy's secretary, he was managing editor, calls and says, Alan wants to see, his name was Alan Hathaway. She says, Alan wants to see you right away. I said to my wife, Ina, I'm glad we didn't move. I'm about to be fired. And I went in there, and he was reading my memo, and he looks up at me, and he says, I didn't know someone from Princeton could do digging like this. From now on, you do investigative work. Well, Todd, with my usual savoir-faire times like that, I said, but I don't know anything about investigative work. And I remember he looked up at me for a very long time, and he said, just remember one thing. Turn every page. Never assume anything. Turn every goddamn page. And I think I've carried that advice in my head ever since.
Did you get a byline on that story on the FAA?
No. You asked the right question. No, I didn't.
Do you remember who did?
No. Well, the two reporters who were covering most of this were Bob Green and Arnold Brophy. But I don't know whose byline was on the story.
Oh, they probably owe you a bigger debt than maybe even they would acknowledge in their later years, I wonder, since they were at the company picnic and you, for the first time, turned every page. That was advice, and you write about this in the book, that was advice that has stuck with you throughout your entire career. Turn every page, assume nothing, always get the next interview, read the next document. Let's take a brief breath, and we'll come right back more with Robert Caro right after this. And on Robert Caro's career of doing work that he says had to make a difference, stay with 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick.
People come from miles around to see my rough tenement crown. Always object, never down, king of the New York.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from ADT, America's trusted home security provider, providing secure smart homes custom designed with everything from video doorbells, indoor and outdoor cameras, smart locks and lights, and professionally monitored carbon monoxide and smoke detectors, all controlled by the sound of your voice or on the go with the ADT Go app. Learn more at ADT.com.
Hey, it's Ophira Eisenberg, host of NPR's Ask Me Another, and I'm here to let you know that every Friday in April, we're bringing you an episode that spotlights women in comedy. You'll hear from Retta, the star of NBC's Parks and Recreation, and I'll talk to Russian Doll actor Greta Lee and co-creator Leslie Headland, and many more. Listen now.
Welcome back to 1A. It's Todd Zwillick in for Joshua Johnson. I'm speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer Robert A. Caro, who's covered the power behind politics and the research and interviewing skills that you need to write about it in the way that he does. Robert Caro, your books on LBJ focus on the span of his life, but they also focus heavily on the culture around him because of the people that were affected by his power, America in the 1950s and the 1960s. And in your short memoir, shortish memoir, Working, you say that there are a couple of songs that really exemplify this period for you.
Yes.
And here's one of them. It's a song that I know you'll recognize, and almost all of our listeners will as well. We Shall Overcome, the famous spiritual and protest song, not just from the 60s, but from long, long before, especially among American black people and Negroes protesting their conditions in America. A lot of Americans know this song, Robert Carroll. Why is it so important to you and the stories that you've told and you continue to tell?
You know, when Lyndon Johnson picks up the banner of the civil rights movement, and decides to pass the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. That was the song that they were singing in the streets. In March 1965, they're singing it in Selma, Alabama, where the police violence against the marchers, the dogs sicked on them, the deputy sheriffs with their bullwhips riding into the marchers, using their whips. And Lyndon Johnson is going to give this speech to Congress. And the civil rights leaders have always wondered in their hearts how much he was with them. In this speech, he says, it's not just them who Negroes, he used the word Negro, it's not just Negroes who must overcome. We must overcome. We must overcome our prejudice. We must pass this law. And he said, and we shall overcome. He picked up the words that of the anthem of the civil rights movement. Very interesting. Martin Luther King was listening to this speech in the living room of one of his supporters down in Selma. And when Johnson says himself, we shall overcome, his aides turn around to look at Dr. King, and he's crying. And it's the only time they ever saw Martin Luther King cry. So you said there are two songs which symbolize the 60s to me. That's part of the glorious things that Lyndon Johnson does. But there's another song, Waist Deep in the Big Muddy. It's about Vietnam. Waist deep in the big muddy, and the big fool says to push on. Waist deep, hip deep, and the big fool says to push on. So the other half of Lyndon Johnson's story in the 19th, not that you can make it half and half, is Vietnam and how he led this country into a war in the jungles of Asia. I mean, think of it. He sent almost 600,000 men over there. We dropped more bombs on Vietnam than we dropped on Germany in World War II. So there are two sides, a bright and a dark side to Johnson's presidency.
And the fool says, push on in that song. That is Lyndon Johnson, the fool, and the decisions that would ultimately undo his presidency and the subject of what you're working on now. I'd like to go back to that scene you just set, though. We Shall Overcome, where protesters are outside the White House. They're singing it as Johnson goes up to the hill in the limo. Yes. Set the scene, though, inside the limo, because you talk about turning every page, maybe not on paper, but turn every page with the people who are talking to you to give witness to the power and the work of Lyndon Johnson, because you went inside the limousine that night on the way to make that speech, We Shall Overcome.
Well, I went and saw it. Todd, you asked good questions. You've really read my books carefully.
I have, sir.
So Johnson is sitting in the back seat of the limousine with a loose leaf notebook with his speech open on his lap, going through it. In the opposite him are his three speech writers, Horace Busby, Richard Goodwin, and Jack Valenti. So I talked to all three of them, Goodwin and Busby, at length, and I would say to them, what did you see or what did you hear in that ride? At first they'd say nothing, you know. But finally, Busby said, you know, well, there was one thing. As our car turns out of the gates of the White House onto Pennsylvania Avenue to drive up to Capitol Hill, the protesters are right there. Pennsylvania Avenue was not at all closed off. They could come right up to the fence next to the White House. And they're singing right into the car, We Shall Overcome. And they're saying, they're chanting, hey, hey, LBJ, just you wait till 68, to show him that they think he's not supporting the civil rights movement enough. And I said to Busby, what was Johnson's reaction? And he said he never looked up from turning the pages of his loose leaf notebook, never once. But Busby really knew Johnson. And I said, but did he hear them? And Busby said, he heard. He gives this speech, the car comes back, and Busby said, you know, when we turned back into the White House, the pickets were all gone.
Johnson shut them all up.
Yes. I mean, it was one of the, you know, to me, Todd, there are great moments in Lyndon Johnson's, memorable moments, memorable to me anyway, and I hope I make people see why I think they're memorable, in Johnson's presidency. This was a shining moment of a man who all his life had wanted to help poor people, and particularly poor people of color. When all the way back to when he's a very poor boy, he has to drop out of college between his sophomore and junior years to make enough money to go on, and he teaches in what they called the Mexican school, Mexican-American school, but they called it the Mexican school, down in a little town called Cotulla in Texas. And I wrote about that time. No teacher had ever cared if these children learned or not. This teacher cared. So when he's writing this We Shall Overcome speech 30 years later, Dick Goodwin says to him, did you really mean, do you really, Goodwin's helping write, he says, you really mean it, or basically he's asking, or is this just a political reason? Johnson says, listen, when I was teaching down there, I swore that if I ever had the power to help these kids, I would use it. Now I have the power, and I mean to use it.
People have debated and will continue to debate the dichotomy of Lyndon Johnson, the man from the South, the friend of Southern racists who used racist language himself, and also his drive, his insistence on helping poor people, unfortunate people, people of color who were downtrodden because of no fault of their own. But to get at his motivation for that latter part, and maybe for both of those sides of Lyndon Johnson, you did more than turn the page. To get at why he was like this, people need to understand that you picked up and took your wife, Ina, the two of you, and you moved to Lyndon Johnson's backyard. You moved to the dirt poor Texas Hill Country.
Yes, because I realized we weren't understanding that country. We weren't understanding the people, and therefore I didn't understand Lyndon Johnson. So I said to Ina, you know, we're going to have to move there and live there to this very isolated, remote, you know, part of America. Ina said, why can't you do a biography of Napoleon?
Well, you'd move to France in that case, but you might not get very far. Robert Caro, you said from your early years as a beat reporter on Long Island and through your work as a biographer that it was important to you in the Young case to work at a paper not just that covered the news, but a paper that was fighting for something, that had that took sides and had something to say about a cause. Why was that important to you as a young person? I guess for a lot of young people it is, but it's not an impulse that sticks with everyone as they pursue their careers. Has it stuck with you?
Oh, I don't know. And I've also taught, I suppose I do feel that way. I try to make my books. I mean, I discovered, you know, I don't know what you learn as you go along, but I realized as I went along doing The Power Broker that if I wanted to write books about political power in America the way I wanted the books to be, I would have to write not only about the powerful, the people who wielded the power, but about the powerless, the people on whom the power was wielded, to show what government, political power can do to people, both for good and for ill.
We've been hearing from 1A listeners who want the chance to ask you a quick question or to Robert Caro. Susan emailed to ask, how shocking was Johnson's loss to Kennedy? Susan's talking about the Democratic convention in 1960, when Johnson was originally vying for the Democratic nomination. He wouldn't have his moment then. Was it a lesson learned for him?
I don't know if it was a lesson learned, but it was certainly a shock. You know, in the 1950s, Lyndon Johnson was the most powerful Democrat in the country. Dwight Eisenhower was president, of course. He was Senate Majority Leader. He was a figure of immense power. I mean, it's not Eisenhower's civil rights bill that's passed then. It's Lyndon Johnson's civil rights bill. The Senate was writing under him its own legislation. So He thinks, and Jack Kennedy is just a freshman senator who's really not doing much in the Senate at all. Johnson has absolute contempt for him. He used to say about Kennedy, you know, he's such a lousy senator, he doesn't even know how to address the chair. You know, he used to talk about how sickly he was, yellow all the time, from, in fact, the Addison's disease he had. He thinks he's got it wrapped up. Kennedy is going around the country with his amazing charm and his idealism and taking the states away from Johnson without Johnson realizing what's happening until it's too late.
And you can go behind the scenes in Master of the Senate, since you brought it up, the shuttle diplomacy in the hotels, Robert Kennedy himself up and down the back stairs, Jack Kennedy negotiating with LBJ when Robert doesn't know because Robert doesn't want Johnson on the ticket. They were lifelong enemies, and this was only the midpoint of their animosity, I suppose.
Well, one of the, you know, the hatred, and hatred is a word, you know, as a biographer, yet you don't like to use because it's such a loaded term and it sounds so exaggerated. But I decided after learning about it, hearing about it for a long time, that hatred was the right word to describe the relationship between Lyndon Johnson and Robert Kennedy.
And it came from both directions. You make clear in your books that how capable of hatred, real hatred, Lyndon Johnson was. He had, I would say, an equal partner in this regard. Bobby Kennedy was a hater too.
And he hated Lyndon Johnson. He just, well, he despised Johnson. The story that you tell, which was in my last book, The Passage of Power, where Jack Kennedy has put Johnson, he's about to nominate him that evening at the convention for his vice president. While he's taking a nap during the afternoon, Bobby Kennedy comes down the back stairs of this hotel to Johnson's suite three times to try to get him to withdraw from the ticket. Johnson thought that was the most humiliating moment of his life. He never forgot that afternoon, and he never forgave it.
And you said he never did forgive once you crossed him.
Yes.
That was the moment between them and many subsequent moments where the Kennedys marginalized and embarrassed Lyndon Johnson once he was vice president. Not like a Dick Cheney, not like a vice president of today, despite his skills and being one of the most formidable politicians in modern American history.
You put your finger on it, Todd. That's a great way to sum it up. You know, he was the greatest legislator, the greatest majority leader in American history. The Kennedys won't even ask him for, or in many cases, allow him to give advice on how to get these bills through. When Kennedy puts his civil rights bill before Congress, Johnson has to plead, can I have 15 minutes alone with him? And as I recall, I don't think he ever gets those 15 minutes. Certainly Kennedy never listened to anything he had to say on this bill.
Fascinating bunch of events. And you detail in the book as well, before we take a quick break here, Robert Caro, how Lyndon Johnson's fortunes changed drastically, tragically, with the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. One of my favorite scenes in your book, The Passage of Power, is when a dejected, depressed, self-pitying, really, Lyndon Johnson is really at the low point of his vice presidency. Tragedy strikes the United States when Jack Kennedy is murdered in Dallas, and the transformation as a switch flips in the mind and the actions of Lyndon Johnson. Those who were in the room with him at Parkland Hospital saw him transform from dejected, self-pitying loser into a powerful, directing, take charge president of the United States. It's a fascinating scene that only somebody who interviewed people in the room over and over could know. My conversation with journalist and historian Robert Caro continues in just a moment. This is 1A. Stay close.
Where the ether gods stay, and the sun that is rising will go down on that day.
Support for NPR and the following message come from VSP Individual Vision Plans, offering coverage for a low monthly cost if you don't have vision coverage through an employer. You'll get access to the nation's largest network of independent doctors and hundreds of name brand frames. Plus, you can save more than $200 a year. VSP believes you deserve to see better for life, for less. Discover for yourself at needvspcoverage.com.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, and on the latest episode of How I Built This, how Alice Waters pioneered the farm-to-table movement and revolutionized American cuisine along the way. Check it out on How I Built This from NPR.
It's 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. Your books, Robert Caro, are filled with scenes of people's real lives, whether it's Sam Johnson Houston, the brother of the president, or people who were never known in any other way. The person whose apartment was razed to make one of Robert Caro's expressways across the Bronx, or the farmer who lost his land, or the black woman who tried to register to vote before the dawn of civil rights, or while civil rights was raging. It's a constant theme throughout your work, not just the powerful man in this case at the top, but the lives affected by that power. That's a choice you've made since the beginning. It's cost you a lot of work and a lot of pages turned and a lot of interviews, I'm sure, at times with people who weren't keen to talk. Why yes. Why this mission? Why this choice that is threaded through all of your work?
Well, you know, I think I said before, if I didn't, I should have. It's not always a conscious decision you make, or certainly you don't know it at the beginning. You just learn it, or it grows on you. As you go along, you don't always know the reason for it. I remember that a turning point for me was when I was writing about Robert Moses. You know, he built 627 miles of expressways and parkways around New York City. If you drive on an expressway or parkway in that area, whole New York, you're driving on a road built by Robert Moses. So I'm reading every textbook on the building of highways, and everyone mentions the phrase, the human cost of highways. Not one showed what the human cost was, or even examined in detail what the human cost was. I said to Ina, I think I found a way to do this. I'll take 1 mile of the 627 miles, a mile of the Cross Bronx Expressway, which he tore right through on a straight line through a dense Bronx neighborhood, tearing down 54 apartment houses. He displaced, I think it was 15,000 people. The whole area turned into this vast slum. And I said, I'm going to try to show what happened to that neighborhood. That's not an easy decision to make, Todd, since I'm remembering this now. We were broke at the time. I had a very small advance to write The Power Broker. And you're not, by this time, I wasn't fooling myself about how long the book was going to take. I said to Einar, it's going to take 6 months to do this. You have to read all the weekly newspapers from the neighborhood, get a picture of what it's like, find all these people who live there. They've all moved away. It's hard to track down people sometimes, and interview them. But when I interviewed them, some of them were living, when they had this community, this neighborhood, they really had something. They had friends and neighbors. Even though they were lower middle class people, they had a real nice life. They liked their life. Now they were scattered all over. Some were in little apartments like developments like Co-op City. Some were living with their kids in Westchester. Some were living in housing projects. I found a lot of them. And when I would interview them and I would type up their notes, my notes on what they said at night, the word that was in almost all the interviews over and over again was lonely. And I thought, Moses could have put this highway in a route exactly 2 blocks away. Would have been the parallel route, and it would have spared, all it would have required was tearing down not 54 apartment houses, but 6 small tenements. But he didn't do that because to use that route, at the end of it, he would have had to demolish a business that was very profitable to a number of Bronx Democratic politicians. I said, I want to show what happens to a neighborhood, to the people in it, when one of these highways goes through. Took a long time to research and write that, but I'm not sorry I didn't.
Robert Caro, that drive that you talk about in yourself, I have to get the answer. I can't write it until I know this answer. I have to say, that sounds very LBJ to me. I mean, you've written over and over that he had to win. It wasn't a choice. He had to have it. He couldn't lose. He couldn't rest until he had it. He had to win. And I don't know if I'm reaching, but is there a part of Johnson that drew you to him because maybe you're the same way?
Well, you never know the answer to things like that, Todd, and I don't know the answer to that. I don't think so, but I don't really know. What drew me to Johnson was my interest in political power and my thinking that if I picked the right guy, I could show how political power works, not what we learned in textbooks, but the raw, naked realities of political power, how it works in fact. Johnson used political power. He was a genius in its use. And I felt if I could show how he used, how he accumulated, how he got power, how he used it, and the ends, both for good and for ill, if you want to use that phrase, that he used it for, I would be casting a little new light on the processes of government and political power in America.
Susan sent us this email. My family never got over Robert Moses' impact on their lives, destroying their home and neighborhood. I thank Robert Caro for articulating the pain. And Robert Caro, I want to thank you for joining us this hour. You know, I promised you at the top, and I'm going to keep my promise, that I would not badger you about when the final book will be finished. But I thought that maybe today might be the day that you decide it's time that we can know the title. Is today that day?
Well, no, I'm not going to. I do have the title, but I'm not going to tell you the title.
I had to ask. You know I did. I gave it my shot. We will learn the title.
But you asked terrific questions.
Well, I appreciate that. And you said that I sound like a person who's read your books deeply. And I'm happy to say that not only have I, Robert Caro, but as somebody who spent many, many years as a Senate reporter in that chamber and in the press gallery of the Senate, I could never have done my job well if I hadn't read Master of the Senate. And since I have the chance, I want to thank you for that. Robert Caro, we're going to leave on a song that you mentioned is one of the most important songs driving your journalistic career. This is Waist Deep in the Big Muddy by Pete Seeger, which tells the story of Vietnam and Lyndon Johnson. Robert Caro, biographer, American historian, thank you so much for being here.
It was a real pleasure, Tom.
This show was produced very ably by Morgan Givens and edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, you can visit 1-8.org/staff. As always, this program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for being with us this hour. This is 1A.
The captain's helmet was all that floated by. The sergeant said, "Turn around, men, I'm in charge from now on." And we just made it out of the Big Muddy with the captain dead and gone. We stripped and dived and found his body stuck in the old quicksand. I guess he didn't know that the water was deeper than the place he'd once before been. Another stream had joined the Big Muddy about a half mile from where we'd gone. We were lucky to escape from the Big Muddy when the big fool said to push on.